parents about banquets, belonging, and the messy middle. But I have a confession first. I'm currently binge watching, like I would do it at work if my boss allowed. Like, I'm currently binge watching. You can laugh. Okay. We're supposed to be funny. Okay. I'm currently binge watching the show on Peacock called Traitors. Anyone? No.
Yeah!
Perfect. Maybe one. Hey, it's a reality competition where 20 celebrity and reality star contestants are sequestered in a Scottish castle. You guys, I'm totally into this. I would do the rest of this in a Scottish accent if I could. So at the very beginning of the show, a few of them are selected to be traitors, and the rest are called faithful. The show is very entertaining. It's set on this in Scotland, this over-the-top castle on stunning grounds. There are mysterious buildings and gardens and graveyards and creepy cabins. Oh, it's, yeah. And then every night, the contestants come together at a round table, and they discuss and they strategize. And they point fingers and they try to vote out a traitor. Contestants will go far if they can navigate the challenges and the social dynamics. The main character in our story this morning, Esther, would have been described by the contestants as having good gameplay. This I know. Our main character, Esther, she's wise and cunning and strategic and courageous, and she navigated not only the challenges day, but she managed what I'm calling the messy middle. The Book of Esther, banquets play a key role, and so I'm going to just unpack a few of these. There's a lot of them, but we're going to unpack a few of these this morning. So our first banquet is in chapter 1. King Xerxes hosts this lavish banquet in the capital city of Susa. Friends, this banquet doesn't just last all night. I mean, Natalie can't even go until 10 p.m., but the banquet lasts, that's funny too, it lasts all night. But friends, it also lasts for 179 more nights. Friends, this was 6 months of party. Someone's signing up for that. Okay. The banquet was intended to display the king's vast wealth, his supreme power and influence, and the glory of his empire, which would have stretched from India to Ethiopia. His guest list would have included all kinds of nobles and officials and governors and military leaders. It's the who's who, if you will. There would have been extravagant displays of entertainment and offerings and feasts. The feast would have been grand and over the top, and if I can say it from the chapel stage, yes, it would have been a large, massive, open bar. It was extravagant, it was lavish, it was grand, and it was dramatic. You see, the king paraded women around and then demanded his queen to appear before the guests and show off her beauty. Well, praise the Lord, she refused. I think I like her, right? But her refusal was seen as an act of defiance and an insult to the king's authority. So he dismisses her. He removes his queen Vashti from her position as queen, and he's looking for a new one. The second banquet's in the second chapter, and it's the search for a new queen, right? The old one just left, and now the king's gotta get a new queen. Friends, the real significance in this banquet is that Esther is now introduced into this royal circle. A Jewish exiled woman, raised by her cousin Mordecai, gains the king favor, and then he's like, you, I'm going to make you queen. Okay, the third banquet is in chapter 5, and after gaining the favor with the king, Esther invites the king and the villain in our story, Haman. You can say boo. Yeah, thank you, Noah. Okay. So she invites the king and this evil villain, Haman, to her private banquet. She is preparing to make a plea to the king. And this is where, friends, she uses her good gameplay, and she withholds her request for now, waiting till the moment is just right. We're going to unpack that in 1 second. Okay, our fourth banquet. Things take this dramatic turn in chapter 7, where Esther hosts her next banquet. So she again invites the king and the villain Haman. Ooh, thank you, Brian. Yep. And this time, now she reveals her identity to the king. And then she exposes the villain Haman's evil plot to annihilate her Jewish people. She appeals to the king for mercy and justice. She tells him that her people are in danger of being destroyed. Okay, so spoiler alert. So, the king is enraged. He demands that Haman be punished and be sent and eventually hang on the gallows. I want to pause the banquet history. I know you're like riveted on the edge of your seats, but I want to pause the banquet history for a moment. I want to give you a little more context. Let's back up. The book of Esther is set during the time when the Jewish people were living in exile, unbelonging, if you will. They had been taken captive first by the Babylonians, and then later the Persian Empire overtook them. So now the Persian Empire, you guys, is the superpower at the time of this vast kingdom. Esther and her people are scattered. They are lost. They're alone. They are actually seen as insignificant. I can't imagine people being seen as insignificant. They're disconnected from culture, each other, their history. They're without place or position or power. They're living in uncertainty, away from their homeland. They have no sign of divine intervention, no king, no prophet to guide them. And then living under this foreign rule, it's as if they've been abandoned by God, who, friends, by the way, isn't even mentioned in the book at all. Can you imagine what they're feeling? Can you imagine the emotions that are underpinning their experience? A little bit stressed, uncertain, abandoned, overwhelmed. Professor Jon Kabat-Zinn describes overwhelm as this: the all-too-common feeling that our lives are somehow unfolding faster than the human nervous system and psyche are actually able to manage. I'm sure they feel overwhelmed. Things are unfolding faster than they can manage. Esther's people, friends, are completely at the mercy of this villain Haman. Enraged by Mordecai's defiance, he doesn't bow down to Haman. He plots to wipe the whole people out. So he decides, you guys, in this evil twist, he decides not to look at the campus life calendar to set this date. He decides this random chance method of casting lots to determine the day in which he's going to annihilate all of the people. I can imagine they're afraid, they're living in terror. I once heard that we experience social pain and physical pain in the same place in our brains. They're in pain, they're disappointed, they're discouraged, they're frustrated, they're helpless, they're hopeless. Australian poet Renata describes anguish this way. Anguish. It's one of those words, you understand the meaning of it just by the way it sounds. It has this gnarling rasp to it as you twist your mouth around to say it, kind of like what feeling it does to your insides. It's an awful, drawn-out, knotted-up word. Anguish, friends, is an almost unbearable and traumatic swirl of shock and grief and powerlessness. Things are unfolding faster than they can manage. Ferguson Wilbert, what a name. He says this, there is almost nothing in our lives that isn't touched by a sense of belonging or unbelonging. Remember, belonging is one of our themes in this Esther story today. The Jewish people's sense of belonging in Persia is totally complicated because they're exiles in a foreign land. They're not at home. Esther is certainly navigating this dual identity as both a member of the Jewish exiled community and a royal figure in the Persian Empire. Talk about the messy middle. And then we were faced with the threat of annihilation by Haman. The Jewish community unites in fasting and in praying and in mourning together. So this collective solidarity, this collective togetherness highlights the importance of belonging to community, of belonging to each other. There are these overlapping threads tying together the idea of belonging, both individual and communal. Friends, I don't want to miss this. I almost missed it. Esther is essentially carrying belonging with her. She is outcasted, yet totally involved. Loyal to her people, courageous and cunning, she models to you and I that belonging is rooted in a shared sense of purpose and faith and responsibility. I just finished reading this book called The Way of Belonging by Sarah Westfall. It's a very, it's a powerful guide to this topic of belonging. She says this, and friends, if you don't buy the book, just this is it. Don't tell her. Belonging is a welcome we carry with us. Belonging is a welcome we carry with us. How many times, friends, have you and I said, I don't belong here? I want to challenge that this morning. Belonging isn't a destination. Belonging isn't out there somewhere for us to attain. Belonging isn't about finding the right people and the right place or the right circumstance. Belonging is something we carry with us. Belonging is more becoming. Belonging is about embracing our identity as God's beloved and then extending that welcome to others. Belonging is about becoming a place of welcome. Chandra, you carry belonging from the East Coast to the West Coast. Chandra, you carry it with you wherever you go. Belonging is mobile, it's dynamic, it's fluid, it's adaptable. It moves with us as we move through experiences and places. Belonging is both being and doing, both who you are and what you carry. Here's the point this morning. If Noah writes nothing else down, this is it. This is your calling. You are called to be banquet people who carry belonging with you. That's it. The banquets thrown by the kings in Esther's day, friends, were these luxurious displays of wealth and power and opulence and excess. I'm not suggesting we throw those kinds of I'm suggesting we throw banquets to celebrate deliverance like Queen Esther. Our fifth and final banquet in our story is found in chapter 9. It's called the Feast of Purim. It's the celebration of gratitude and remembrance. It was established by the Jews after their deliverance, this joyous festive occasion where they remember God's providence and Esther's courageous role. Friends, the reversal here is I need to point it out, make it obvious. The name of this banquet that they establish is the Feast of Purim. It means casting of lots. It supersedes evil Haman's fate of chance of destroying them. And then still to this day, friends, the Jewish community pull up seats to the table, and they eat familiar foods, and they retell the story of their courageous conquest. I'm suggesting we do the same. I'm suggesting we throw festive, joyous banquets of remembrance. I'm suggesting we throw banquets like the one found in Luke 14. So in the New Testament, in Luke 14, there's this parable of a banquet and a host that highlights themes in the kingdom of God like humility and inclusivity. The banquet host, he invites, he sends out a candidate invite to a lot of people. And they're a little prideful, they make some excuses, and they don't attend. And so the host sends out even more invitations to the poor, to the crippled, to the blind. And then those people come to the banquet hall, and they fill it to overflowing. I'm suggesting we throw open the doors for a celebration of grace and abundance with an invitation to all. Especially to those who might be excluded, alone, exiled. The banquets that you and I throw shouldn't be about ego or status. They should be about divine invitation to experience the fullness of God. I'm suggesting that we take belonging with us and set the table for community and reconciliation, a celebration of inclusion and generosity, joyous banquets of remembrance. Everyone has a seat. Everyone has a seat. Our calling, friends, this morning is to be banquet people who carry belonging with us. Esther was a banquet person who carried belonging with her, and she did so by navigating the messy middle. She knew who she was. Friends, she was both royal and refugee, both insider and outcast, both noble and nomad, both crowned and castaway. We, too, find ourselves in the messy middle. Because every day we wake up to current national and global events and issues that polarize people to pick a side. Geopolitical tensions, shifting international alliances, escalating humanitarian crises, refugee displacement, extreme weather events, global health pandemics, fragile healthcare infrastructure, deepening health inequalities, erratic power dynamics, turbulent trade wars, cybersecurity threats, political instability, polarizing immigration policies, widespread protests and social unrest. Where's the table? Where's God? Where's the welcome? How do we widen our circles? How do we navigate that really messy, complicated, polarized middle? How do we learn strategic activation like Esther? How do we become more courageous? How do you and I become banquet people who carry belonging with us? That's the question for us today. How do we do it? Sarah Westphal in her book says this: while being is part of the equation, let's not forget that the word belong is a verb that implies movement. It's not static. It does not sit and wait, hoping others come through the door. There are things that we can do to cultivate a life of welcome. I'm going to give you three things this morning that you can do to cultivate that life of welcome, to carry belonging with you. Number one is to own your story. Brennan Manning says, the reconciled heart says that everything that has happened to me had to happen to make me who I am today without exception. To own our story, to be actually reconciled with it, to come to terms with it, to make peace with it. I'm not saying you gotta like it or appreciate it, but we do have to bring our hidden shame, our hidden stories into the light so they can have healing and they can be reconciled. We have to claim the truths about who we are and where we've come from and how I believe about what I used to believe and acknowledge the important nature, the imperfect nature of our lives. Brené Brown writes, we either own our stories or we stand outside of them, denying our vulnerabilities and imperfections, orphaning parts of us that don't fit in with who or what we think we're supposed to be, and then we hustle for other people's approval of our worthiness. Friends, you either own your story or you orphan your story. What if we brave doing the hard work and asked ourselves questions like, what parts of my story have I not owned? What parts aren't reconciled yet? And then what would reclaiming those orphan stories mean for you? What lies did I grow up believing about myself and my story, about what happened to me? And how has God used your story to draw him closer to yourself? Maybe you and I become banquet people who carry belonging with us when we own our story. Number two, when we offer empathy. And you heard me say it before, friends, empathy is reflecting back the truth about someone, about what they're feeling. Empathy involves mirroring. Empathy is not, hear me clearly, connecting to an experience, because we all have different experiences. So empathy is connecting with the emotions that underpin that experience. Empathy is a choice, a brave choice, because if I am going to connect with you through empathy, it means first identifying something that I connect with in myself. Before our first son was born, my husband and I had a miscarriage. And most of you in this room probably have not had that experience. But almost all of you have probably experienced the emotions that underpin that experience. Grief, loss, disappointment. And that's how we connect. We have to resist the temptation that when someone shares with us, we just want to fix it and give advice. Empathy isn't about fixing. Empathy is the brave choice to be with someone in their darkness, not a race to turn on the lights and feel better. Thank you, Brené Brown. It's not our job to make things better or to relate through an experience that I might have had. No, our job is to connect. Brené Brown writes, one of the signature mistakes with empathy is we believe that we can take our lenses off and look through the lens of someone else if we can't. Our lenses are soldered on to who we are, but what we can do is honor people's perspectives even when they're different from ours. We become banquet people who carry belonging with us when we own our story, we offer empathy, and then friends come to the table. The table is not about perfection. This is not a perfect table. Whoopsie. Or performance, or excuses about lack of time, lack of space, lack of money. Offering hospitality to each other is not a complicated choreography of competition and showing off. The table, when we come to it, it's about nourishment and connection, not neurotic proving. The table calls us to leave the heavy weight of comparison and competition and exhaustion, and then to recraft a life of meaning and connection. The table is a place of presence and peace and provision where God is present with his people. Friends, the table is a place where the truth is declared about who we are and whose we are. I think it can be a place of healing, the place of forgiveness, the place of relearning and re-educating and re-seeing the other. We become banquet people who carry belonging with us when we own our story, when we offer empathy, and when we come to the table. You and I are called to be banquet people. For Christmas, I got this beautiful book called The Book of Belonging. It's an inclusive Bible storybook for kids, but it's probably for us. And in it, the author paints a beautiful picture of what the forever wedding feast described by John in Revelation will be like. Let me tell you about it. In the end, there'll be a never-ending table stretching past the horizons, and all the seats will be filled with friends and people from every tribe and language and nation, and togetherness and belonging will be our anthem. All the best and beautiful things we love about parties and weddings and feasts will be present. Friends, we will be the living reminder for eternity that belonging is God's dream. God, the God of garden parties and seaside parties and tabernacle feasts, the God who came to you and I as a baby and welcomed the so-called outsiders and feasted with the forgotten. The God whose communities crowded around tables and pulled up more seats. The God who is faithful and insists on belonging. We are banquet people. We are belonging people. People who live in the messy middle. People who are strategic and thoughtful and kind. People who own their stories and offer empathy and come to the table. Friends, you this morning, you're calling. You are banquet people who carry belonging with you. And who knows? Perhaps you've come to this place and this position for such a time as this.